people who've worked inside criminal justice and public safety systems, you know, we have a saying, which is hurt people hurt people. This is something that is well understood by experts in the field, by practitioners, by community-based organizations. And what that means is when we do nothing in response to someone being hurt, if people remain unsafe and experience trauma and don't get help to heal from trauma, their life trajectories change. It should come as no surprise that potentially committing a crime in the future may be an option. We can do so much to help people, however, because just as hurt people hurt people, the other saying that we have is healed people heal people.
This week's guest is Lenore Anderson, co-founder and president of Alliance for Safety and Justice, one of the largest reform advocacy organizations in the US. It combines smart policy reform with grassroots organizing to replace a reliance on incarceration with more effective public safety solutions. With deep domain experience in law, policy, and justice reform, Lenore has recently published In Their Names, a book that not only provides historical insight into an indictment of how the victims' rights movement warped the American justice system, but created a cycle of trauma. However, Lenore also provides a roadmap into breaking the cycle of trauma and a future vision for justice, healing, and creating safer communities and society. Now, thanks to David Risley for the connection. And at the end of this interview, David joins the podcast as he discusses where their work intersects. Now, over to Lenore. Welcome, Lenore.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to be here. And where does this podcast find you?
I'm in Oakland, California.
Well, really want to get into what you're currently doing and the world-changing ideas that you're advocating for and the actions you're taking to implement them. But before we do, really do want to get started by understanding a bit more about Lenore the person, who you really are, and who or what made you you.
Those are some deep questions to start with, Mark. Appreciate you jumping in there. I'm a mom. In most of my identity, and I'm a dog mom too. I love family. That's really what motivates me most of the time is family. I was born in Waco, Texas, moved around a lot as a child.
Not far from here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Moved around a lot as a child. My father was in the military. And so part of my identity is a military brat, like many people who grew up in that environment. It meant, you know, getting a lot of exposure to lots of different parts of the country at an early age. And I think some of that exposure, you know, we lived in Air Force bases throughout the South. And he retired when I was entering high school in California. I feel like a lot of my worldview comes from those early years experiencing different parts of the country and seeing both similarities and differences. I really value hard work, Mark. I think that that's, you know, when I think about what I offer, it's not, you know, I don't conceive of myself as needing to be or even able to be the smartest person or the person with the most amazing personal story, but I will work hard and I will work hard to achieve a goal. And that's what I've been trying to do for the last couple of decades, at least.
Was that ethic ingrained in you because of your father's sort of military background? I mean, I understand the reason I say that is my father was in the Navy, or what was in the UK was called the Fleet Air Arm on the aircraft carriers. And I certainly remember being, let's say, it being highly encouraged to work hard, sometimes with a boot and a back of his hand.
Indeed. So I learned about hard work from my father. There's no question about that. I learned about compassion and generosity from my mother, and I learned about hard work and taking pride in effort from my dad. I'm deeply grateful to both of them.
It's a good combination. Compassion, generosity, and hard work.
Yeah, my mom, I grew up memories of her painting. She's a painter and a lover of art, a lover of music. And so, yeah, it was a very lucky combination for me.
obviously you slightly answered that second question as to who or what made you, your parents. And what about siblings, teachers, and any mentors or any defining memorable experiences in those early years?
Oh, yeah. Well, so I'm the youngest of four siblings, and my oldest sister, her name's Michelle, she instilled a value of social justice in me when I was very, very young. You know, she's been a social justice activist herself, and I really looked up to her as a young child and sort of wanted to emulate what she was teaching me. You know, I think the thing, you know, my family were white Americans, and we moved all around the United States. When we were in Nebraska, my father was getting ready to be relocated to Louisiana. And I remember my dad, you know, sitting us down and telling us that we don't tolerate racism in our family. And my sister Michelle really was a beacon for me in sort of emulating what it looks like to disagree when we see, you know, issues of social injustice coming up. And, you know, that was sort of, you know, back in the 80s. And, you know, I just remember those early conversations with her about, you know, sometimes when you value human rights, when you value racial equality, it means that you disagree with the people around you and even your friends. And you just have to do that because that's what it looks like to care about all of humanity.
Wow. What led to her taking such a stance on social justice?
Oh, that'd be such a great question for her. She'd be a wonderful person, a wonderful person for you to talk to. It's funny. I think she has always had that independent spirit, definitely learned about both hard work and compassion from her parents. And, you know, I think she just had her own role models. I know she had many early teachers and feminist activists who influenced her own way of thinking.
Before we're getting into the what you're working to achieve, as we say, before you leave this mortal coil, a long way to go, what are your earliest memories or the realization that you did actually feel either a desire to or obliged to make a difference in the world?
Well, you know, Mark, I often tell a story about my high school years. So I went to high school and grew up as a teenager and young adult in California in the 1980s and 90s. And I was a troublemaker as a kid. I had a foot-tall mohawk. And did it indeed. And I took great pride in rebelling. And that got me in occasional trouble. You know, whether it was with neighbors or teachers or occasionally police. And the response to me, Mark, was one of second chances. It was a response that was based in a presumption that I would grow out of it and steering me in the right direction, helping me. You know, I had teachers who let me pass classes that I didn't pass. Police would let me go home instead of taking me to juvenile hall. My parents had resources to help me with therapy and other finding a job and things like that, getting me on the right path. There was, like I said, a basic presumption that I would grow out of it. And it wasn't until I was older that I understood that response to me as a troublemaker, as a teenager, was not a response that's universally experienced. In fact, it's the exception to the rule, and it's really primarily a second chances response that's reserved for middle-class youth and white youth. And just what was happening contextually really matters here. Mm-hmm. You know, the 1980s and 90s in California, that was the height of the tough-on-crime movement in the United States. This is when politicians were, you know, kind of stepping over each other to look tougher and tougher on crime. In particular, in California at that time, there was what was referred to as a war on youth.
Right. Am I right in saying, was it Governor Jerry Brown?
So there was Pete Wilson, Governor Brown in his very first term, followed by a series of other governors, all passed laws that enacted mandatory sentencing and tough sentencing. And this really ratcheted up the power of the criminal justice system. So at the same exact time that youth of color and low-income youth across the state were being surveilled and arrested for the minorest of infractions, driven into the juvenile and criminal justice systems, here I was making some of the same mistakes and getting second and third passes. Well, fast forward a decade after high school, I'm in law school. And I come out of law school, and my first job out of law school was actually representing youth who were facing time behind bars. So I was working with parents of incarcerated youth to help those parents advocate for alternatives to incarceration. You know, we're talking young people who are facing literally years behind bars. And one of the things that stood out to me so much in those early years, Mark, was how similar these kids were from who I was as a teenager. The response was the only difference, not the child, not the teen. And so for me, you know, the work that I do is a foundationally, it's a commitment to racial equality. It's, you know, my commitment to do everything I can, given the opportunities and the privileges that I've received. It's doing everything I can to give back and to create a more fair and equitable and safer world for everyone.
Wow. Can you, do you ever sit back and reflect on what would have happened if you had gone down the alternative path, if they had, let's just say, reacted the same way to you as they were to other kids your age that ended up in prison, what a different path you would have taken?
Yeah, I mean, and we know that path. We can look and see, and I've seen what has happened over and over again. So many young people who are facing time behind bars were hurt long before they ever acted out. And so many times there was no support and no help whatsoever. And so, you know, when young people are getting in trouble, we can look at it as a sign that something may be wrong, that we need to jump in and help this young person. Or we can look at it as, oh, they're committing a crime, and so we're going to offer some level of punishment. And how we look at it changes everything. And so, you know, what I know is if I had received the same, just, you know, punish her response, I would have ended up on the same path.
Okay, that's really great context. The irony is that, yeah, 10 years on, you found yourself in law representing these kids when you could have gone down such a different path. But what I'm also interested in, that even with a strong sense of justice, when I know what it's like being an idealistic, rebel-rousing teenager wanting to sort of overturn the system, often reality bites and the real life kicks in, and you've got responsibilities and you have to take a proper day job, and suddenly those ideals fade. But for you, they didn't. You actually did go on to study ethics and political science and then law. So obviously there was something inside you still burning. You didn't go down the path of going, well, I'm just going to go and do a engineering degree or a master's in business. What was it that was still burning inside you that set you on that path?
Purpose.
Mm-hmm.
I think for me, guiding my life in service of purpose makes me get up every day. You know, and as I get older, this may be the kind of thing that maybe I would wish I felt differently about, but I've never been motivated by money in that way. I've not been motivated by some of the sort of things that might lead towards making rational decisions about a career. You know, even the concept career wasn't something that resonated necessarily. I wanted to make sure that I was in service of a larger purpose. That's really what's always sort of kept me going. I feel so grateful to have learned the truth about injustice. Mm. And for me, it's the kind of thing that you can't unsee. Once I understood intimately the scale of violence that has happened inside our justice system, the scale of disregard that communities, in particular communities of color, have experienced, that is not something I can look away from. And my hope is that it's not something that anyone who gets the right level of exposure could look away from either.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you are in the midst of probably a multi-decade journey to right the wrongs from the 80s and what we're about to go on and talk about. And you're confronting system level change, which is part, arguably, of the American political and cultural DNA that has been sort of woven through the fabric of society since the 80s, as you say, in an unjust manner, you know, deepening probably the racial inequities and the injustice that already existed. Aside from just that daily, waking up with daily purpose, you must have to confront, I mean, it's natural human emotion is to confront fragility and doubt. And when you face either uncertainty or resistance, as there must be a fair bit of resistance to what you are proposing and arguing for and advocating for, how do you deal with that? What keeps you going?
You know, in the world of social change, we lose a lot more than we win. This is not a path that anyone should be on if they're looking for accolades.
It's not a quick win business.
No. You're not having, you know, celebration parties every weekend. But it's not about me. Like, I think for me, the reason I don't shy away from the risk, the defeat, the devastating losses after years of trying to get the simplest of reforms passed is because I am grounded in the truth, which is whatever I can do, I should do. And it's also not about me. I have been so inspired to meet people along the way. You know, when we're doing a campaign and we came so close to winning one of our campaigns in one of our states and, you know, said we lost. And the next day, one of our members, that campaign changed my life because now I know that my voice matters and I can go down to the state capitol and I can, you know, try again. Mm-hmm. That kind of collective power is what this is all about. And it's never gonna just be me doing this work. Even when we lose, we move the ball forward for thousands by giving them a voice in our public policies.
In a completely different interview area, I try and interview these people called the difference makers like yourself and storytellers and then domain experts in specific areas. And I interviewed this guy called Don Smith, who an ex-colleague of mine from advertising in Edinburgh back in the day. And he's now an inventor. And I was asking him sort of similar questions of how he deals with, you know, when you have failure, let's say, or lack of achievement of what your aims and goals are, goes with being an inventor. And he talked about this philosophy from a German philosopher called emergence. He said, there is no success and failure. Everything is just in a state of emergence. What you were 10 years ago, what you are today, where the world is then and where the world is now is not where the world's going to be in 5, 10, 15 years' time. Everything is emerging. And you are a part of that emergence. The actions you take, the decisions you make, the actions you don't take, you are part of influencing emergence. So it's interesting when you describe that. It just makes me think of this. We are in a sense of emergence towards a more just, equitable society.
Yeah, that's right. The risk of not doing anything is so much greater than the risk of doing something, right? Yeah, I mean, you know, and there's so many benefits. You know, again, even if you lose the campaign, even if the policy reform doesn't become enacted, the lives that have been touched by taking that stand, you're providing visibility and dignity to people who deserve it. And that alone is worth the price of admission.
You'd mentioned, obviously, hard work, compassion, and generosity that came from your mother and father. But it sounds like there's quite a tenacious spirit in there. What would you describe your natural gifts or talents as?
Oh, yeah. Well, I have been described as tenacious. That is an adjective that has come up
bubbles,
on occasion.
It bubbles to the top.
You know, I do value relentlessness. Mm-hmm. I don't know who originally said it, but this concept that always resonates with me is this idea of like, we are our own worst enemies. Like we're in the way of ourselves. And so if you can get out of the way of yourself, what becomes possible for you? You know, I love that way of thinking because what it means is every day that I get up, my job is to get out of my own head and into what I can do, with my hands, what I can do with my voice, what I can do in community with other people. If I'm out of my own way, so much can become possible through those actions. So, I think that that's something that I really value. I also just really value taking responsibility. The world is ours to shape.
What do people compliment you for?
Oh, well, let's see. What do I get complimented for? Good listener. I hear that one. Nice wardrobe, which I love. You gotta have a hobby.
Definitely do that, yeah.
You gotta have a hobby. Mine is clothes. No, in seriousness. So, you know, good listener, hard worker. And, this idea of like getting things done and just sort of showing what it looks like to get things done. I think I've been complimented a lot for my ability to move balls forward.
Cool. Well, let's talk about moving the balls forward with the Alliance of for Safety and Justice. You're the president of it.
Yes.
And I've said at the beginning, it supports survivors and establishes a vision for victims' rights. And it's based on providing trauma recovery. And we'll come and talk a bit more about trauma, something that's come up in recent conversations, societal level trauma. But in doing this, you are breaking the cycle of violence and shifting the narrative towards services and prevention instead of vengeance and incarceration. First of all, can you explain how your organization operates? As mentioned, you're not only just trying to change policy, but you are actually confronting these deep-seated beliefs and trying to change opinions about justice, which is no small order.
The Alliance for Safety and Justice is an organization that is focused on state-level policy change.
Multi-state.
We operate in 8 states currently.
Okay.
You know, would be delighted to work in more as we grow. We're a decade old, and so we've made it into 8 states in 10 years. And our model is pretty straightforward. We focus on organizing people and changing laws. We focus on building constituencies of people who are affected by both violence and incarceration. We have 2 constituency groups. One is called CRIM Survivors for Safety and Justice, about 200,000 members strong. These are all people who've been directly impacted by violence who are advocating for support services and also advocating for a new approach to public safety. We have another constituency group called Time Done. And Time Done is focused on, it's people with old records who are focused on reducing the barriers to economic mobility that people with old convictions face. And so we organize those 2 constituency groups and we combine that with policy proposals. So we go into state houses across our states and we meet with elected officials and legislators and we make policy proposals. And then we lobby those proposals and advocate to get those enacted into law. In the decade since we began, we've succeeded in advancing more than 90 different policy and budget reforms in the 8 states that we work in. And those 90 different laws that we've enacted have had a good impact. We've been able to reduce incarceration and community supervision by more than 300,000 people across the country. And we've been able to reallocate, upwards of $1 billion towards community-based victim services, crime prevention, reentry, things like that.
Wow, that's incredible. Yeah, that must provide wonderful case studies for you to then, even when you do encounter resistance or failure to affect the changes you want, presumably these are great case studies to then argue and advocate for further change.
Yeah, we have learned a lot. And there's a lot of lessons that can be pointed to about what it looks like to advance public safety from a new framework. And it's so critical right now to look with eyes wide open at what actually happened the first time around when crime was a crisis and what the response should be now. We're in a political moment where concern for crime is, again, very high. Many communities have suffered tremendous, significant increases in violence in the last few years. And so it's really critical that we do take a look at the case studies and we really do look at what happened, whether or not tough on crime worked the first time around and what would work better this time.
Well, I mean, when I first of all encountered the article in The Guardian and that described was an interview you did, the launch of your book, I had no real context around the historical context around the factors that led to the tough laws back in the 80s. Perhaps you can give some sort of background to those that led to those tough laws, the unforgiving sentences, the brutal penal system that exists here, and why you think those policies failed and the evidence that they so clearly failed, and why it didn't actually result in what was intended to do, which was actually to create safer communities and cities and satisfy the needs of victims when it clearly it didn't.
1980s, there was a tremendous amount of political attention to the issue of crime, and rightfully so. It was a big problem back then, just as it is today. There were divergent political movements that ended up kind of becoming braided together. And I, you know, as a Californian, a lot of this actually started in my home state. So the tough on crime movement began actually in the 70s and 80s and into the 90s, strongest in California, kind of spread across the country. The victims' rights movement also began in California and kind of spread across the country. What was happening was there was, it, for victims' rights advocates, they were lifting up a truth, which is that victims are disregarded by the criminal justice system. You know, when it comes to the world of criminal court, victims are oftentimes little else than a witness that can help a prosecutor secure a victory or a conviction. And so that dynamic meant that for far too many victims, the justice system was a traumatizing experience. It wasn't one where they received help and support. And so lifting up that truth of like, you know, victims are disregarded or treated poorly by the justice system was accurate. But there was a law and order sort of political strategy happening that kind of captured those same messages and put the solution to victim disregard on the side of toughening up the justice system. Some very wise, you know, sort of political strategists, kind of took this mantle of victims' rights and usurped it for the purposes of advocating for the toughest possible laws. And the idea was, okay, if victims aren't being treated properly, then the response should be to give a bunch of money and power to criminal justice bureaucracies. That resulted in, you know, sort of this era that we now refer to as the tough on crime era, where politicians of all stripes, whether they were Democrat, Republican, it didn't matter, were calling for, we want to stand on the side of victims. And so we want tough anti-gang laws. We want tough drug laws. We want tough conditions inside prisons. We want to strip rehabilitation from the prisons. We want to diminish the rights of people in the justice system in order to strengthen, allegedly, the rights of victims. Well, that, you know, resulted in a massive transfer of power and cash, right? We're talking about criminal justice agencies, you know, turning into a political powerhouse, really. I mean, before this era, it wasn't as if criminal justice agencies or their associations wielded a tremendous amount of political power. But over this time period, they then became kind of a behemoth and a bit of a political machine. So we saw, you know, incarceration increase dramatically. We saw opportunities for release go down for people. Mm-hmm. We saw rehabilitation stripped from the justice system. And this all happened, obviously, along severely biased race and socioeconomic lines. And so that was sort of what happened. And the problems, right? You know, we are lucky to live today in a time where many people have offered a thorough assessment of all the ways in which mass incarceration has been harmful. you know, there's the impact of mass incarceration in terms of discrimination and racial disparities, in terms of who's incarcerated. There's the financial impact of all that tough justice in terms of just extreme waste of money on these bloated prisons that are, you know, ineffective and violent. But there's
recidivism
and,
as well.
And recidivism as well. Yeah, that's right. And, but then there's this other impact that has been less talked about, which is a part of the inspiration behind why I wrote the book, which is, well, what was all the impact of that on victims, right? If we look politically at this idea that, you know, we were allegedly in the 80s and 90s trying to protect victims, if you take at face value what was said politically, and, you know, then I wanted to explore, you know, this question of what the impact on victims is. What we know to be true from our work on the ground in communities and in state houses across the country is that this myth that tough justice is good for victims is false, right? Mm-hmm. That in fact, we have hurt more victims of crime through building up the mass incarceration system than we have ever helped. And that's really sort of how there's this, you know, how this chasm between people who've survived violence and the justice system, that chasm is what I was looking to explore.
Mm-hmm. Something else that you talk about in your book is the simplistic issue or simplistic approach of bucketing either victims of crime or as a perpetrator of crime. And it overlooks the complexity of the victimized. It's something you mentioned when we started the conversation about often a perpetrator is a victim of some sort of crime or injustice or suffering some sort of trauma. You've said that people who are frequently vulnerable to everyday violence, low income folks, people of color, immigrants, individuals with disabilities, you know, those who are unhoused, these are ongoing societal barriers to being protected from harm. And it leads to the likelihood that they may later commit a crime. You've got this amazing stat. It's roughly 90 to 95% of people who get arrested and convicted of crime were a victim before. When these laws were enacted back in the 80s, was there no evidence back then that people that commit crime, even back in the 80s, that was still a recurring issue? And given that is the case now, what is being done today to try and address this now that we know the reality?
Yeah, and I think that the world of politics is not always informed by the world of science, right? To say the least. You know, and so I think when we look at what was happening politically in that era, there was the myth that tough justice was good for victims. And there was also the myth that there's, you know, sort of innocent victims on one side of a map and then, you know, people who are bad who commit crimes on another and never the twain shall meet. Mm-hmm. And that's a political myth that's been convenient for many people's reelection campaigns. But it actually is, couldn't be further from the truth when in terms of looking at the complexity of victimization and cycles of violence. You know, I want to take a step back and just, you know, sort of say a couple big picture comments and then get into this relationship between people who are hurt and people who hurt others. So there's three reasons why sort of the tough justice era that led to mass incarceration has hurt victims. The first is because there is no evidence that the tougher the sentence, the less crime you have, right? In fact, the National Academy of Sciences said, you know, in the most comprehensive report written to date in 2014, that lengthy sentences are ineffective as a crime control measure. Mm-hmm. There is no evidence no deterrence. This isn't going to actually turn people's lives around to give them 25 years as opposed to 15, as opposed to 10. Mm-hmm. So that sort of is one reason why victims were hurt. The second is because in doing all of that mass incarceration under the mythology that longer sentences worked, you depleted an immense amount of resources that could have been available at the community level for investment in community-based public safety and community-based crime prevention. But then the third reason that mass incarceration has been so harmful for victims of crime is because it's literally blinded the public, right? It has blinded the public to the complexities and the nuances about how crime and victimization happens and to the true needs of most people who are survivors. And so, you know, if we are able to get rid of the mask, to take away the mythology, to let go of, you know, the stories about, you know, crime and violence and actually look at the facts, that's when you can start to see what we talk about, you know, people who've worked inside criminal justice and public safety systems, you know, we have a saying, which is hurt people, hurt people. You know, this is something that is well understood by experts in the field, by practitioners, by community-based organizations. And what that means is when we do nothing in response to someone being hurt, if people remain unsafe and experience trauma and don't get help to heal from trauma, their life trajectories change. It should come as no surprise that potentially committing a crime in the future may be an option. We can do so much to help people, however, because just as hurt people hurt people, the other saying that we have is healed people heal people, right? And so if we could actually build an approach to public safety that was grounded in healing trauma, we would go so much further to stop the cycle of crime and violence than what our tough justice system has built. So, you know, and just to then get into a little bit more about, you know, kind of what you were describing. So, yeah, so, you know, 90% of the people going into our criminal justice system have prior histories of trauma, you know, have been experienced victimization. It's really critical to understand that oftentimes this has been repeated trauma, right? Repeated experiences of victimization and little access to, you know, the kinds of supports that we all need, that everyone who has experienced trauma needs to recover from that. And one of the most sinister aspects of American criminal justice is people who have experienced trauma, who then later commit a crime, are placed inside facilities that are literally designed to cut people off from humanity. Like, these are places that are designed to, you know, exacerbate trauma. That's our current, you know, sort of response, whether it's, you know, the solitary confinement or the crowded prisons with daily fighting and suppression from guards. I mean, these are not environments that are in any way conducive to what we would need to do to improve public safety, which is heal trauma, address underlying drivers, provide people pathways to engage in behavior change. That's not going to come from the kind of toxic culture that is built up in too many American prisons.
What you just described about hurt people, is that also tie into what you described as a hierarchy of harm?
So in the book, when I'm talking about and describing what I refer to as a hierarchy of harm, what I'm talking about there is the fact that we have a criminal justice system that has never been very good at seeing most victims, mm-hmm. right? So we have something that isn't talked about all that much, but is profoundly true, is that we have a criminal justice system that discriminates against victims frequently. And this discrimination can take the form of which victims get access to victim compensation or victim assistance in the aftermath of being hurt, to which cases are investigated most thoroughly, to which victim experiences make the nightly news and drive politicians to introduce laws and try and reallocate money towards something. When it comes to being a victim in the United States, there is a hierarchy of whose harm matters to our criminal justice system and whose harm has not mattered all that much.
Which I'm assuming is racial biased.
It's along race and socioeconomic lines. And we have seen this. And let me just give you some examples, Mark, because these are some devastating truths that are not elevated in the public discourse on crime all that much. In the city of New Orleans in 2017, a report came out that the New Orleans prosecutor's office had arrested 150 victims of crime over a 5-year period, arrested to compel their testimony in court. Okay. We're talking victims of domestic violence, victims of human trafficking, victims who witnessed or had been victims of shootings in the neighborhood. Why would they
not want to testify?
Well, so let's answer that in two parts. First, just to give you a flavor for what I mean by the hierarchy of harm, the experiences of victimization that the victims who were arrested by the prosecutor's office had were diverse. The unifying feature of which victims were arrested and which were not was almost all of the victims who were arrested by the prosecutor's office were low-income victims of color, almost all of whom were women, okay? So that's who is being arrested, all right? And then to your second question, which is, why would they not want to testify? When we have a justice system that has been as racially biased as ours has, we have to confront the truth that there is a massive trust gap, okay? Many communities, particularly communities of color, have not been able to rely on the justice system to deliver protection or to deliver safety. It is, for many people, it is actually more dangerous to interact with the justice system than it is to stay away from it. You know, we have not had a justice system that has been very good at protecting people and allowing people to be assured that there won't be any retaliation. We have not had a justice system that has been very good at protecting survivors of things like domestic violence and human trafficking. You know, this is not a place where people can rely on, hey, if I engage, I'm going to be okay on the other side. For many, that it's actually more dangerous. So when you look at what the prosecutor's office in New Orleans did, the reason I think this is so illustrative of this dynamic of a hierarchy of harm is that the prosecutor's office was arresting primarily low-income victims and victims of color for the purposes of compelling their testimony with no regard for the impact on the lives of the victims who were experiencing this. It was so shocking, you know, that, you know, remarkable lawyers at organizations like the ACLU and Civil Rights Corps came together, filed lawsuits, you know, tremendously courageous survivors like Renata Singleton came forward and told their story about being incarcerated. You know, she was someone who, it was a misdemeanor case. The perpetrator didn't spend a single day in jail. The victim of crime, Renata, she was in jail for 5 days. You know, the impact, that collateral impact on family.
It's astounding.
It's astounding.
You just can't believe that.
So these champions for justice come forward and, you know, survivors leading the way, tell their stories, lawyers file a lawsuit. It made national news, right? So this was, you know, something that drove headlines. You know, there was shock that we would be arresting victims when there's so many other ways, by the way, to compel testimony if that's really your goal. And so much so that the laws changed. So now there is a court order and New Orleans can no longer engage in this arresting of victims. But it's just one example of what happens chronically. I mean, you know, my organization, you know, we work with survivors of crime across the country. That's who our membership is. And, you know, Mark, it's regular for us to hear from our membership. Oh, you know, the police officers, you know, never called me back. The investigator won't tell me what happened in the case. You know, I applied for victim compensation, but they said my application was denied because I didn't have a permanent home address. You know, I mean, this is what is happening with alarming frequency. And this matters a lot. When people have been hurt by violence and we do not provide them with help, we are setting them up to be even more vulnerable than they were before they were hurt. The long-term impacts of violence are substantial. You go into debt, right? Victimization debt. You know, we have so many wonderful people in our organization whose loved ones have been killed by violence. They took on enormous financial burdens when that person died. If you can't get help recovering from that debt, you know, that has lifelong impacts. You know, people who've been injured by gun violence or domestic violence who can no longer work in their job because of physical injury, not getting a pathway to a new approach to earn income, not to mention the impacts of trauma, which are well known in terms of PTSD, sleeplessness, depression. These are all resolvable issues. And if we cared about public safety, you'd think it'd be the top thing we'd be doing.
Yeah, it's totally shocking. I mean, I can't just get over that stat. That was 2017 in New Orleans.
That's right.
Is it being addressed or is it continuing?
I mean, you know, luckily, and this is what we find and kind of what I try and chronicle a little bit in the book is at every turn, you see survivor leaders standing up and fighting for change and winning. You know, there's that, you know, my organization has been able to advocate for and win the establishment of 41 trauma recovery centers across the country. We've changed victim compensation laws to allow for more people to be eligible. And in New Orleans, yeah, it was, you know, courageous survivor leaders who came forward, lawsuits and grassroots organizers who changed the laws. And, you know, this was all just very recently, right? The case settled within just a couple of years. So this is present day. These are present day struggles for fairness and visibility for all victims.
Another thing that you touch on in the book that is an issue in its own right that's been going on for decades, which is the war on drugs. And without getting into the ineffectiveness, arguable ineffectiveness, or blunt ineffectiveness of the war on drugs, you stated that it, along with the push to increase victim rights, it's led to an increase in surveillance in predominantly low-income neighborhoods, and neighborhoods often of color as well, which just is another factor in reinforcing racial disparities. Aside from all the work you're doing, I mean, what could be done about that?
You know, one of the stories I tell in the book is about the city of Cleveland. And this is a city that, frankly, wasn't doing anything all that much different than any other city at the time. But when the political call to action was tough on crime, what that resulted in was a transfer of cash from the federal government to the cities, mostly for police departments, mostly to militarize those police departments. And that meant that surveillance, particularly in communities of color and urban communities, skyrocketed. And what you give money to is what the justice system will be good at doing, right? So, you know, there was a drastic increase in the city of Cleveland in the number of Clevelanders of color who were being arrested for simple crack pipe possession and driven into state prison. And what's important to note, and that's because that's what Cleveland got money to do, was to prosecute as tough as possible on, you know, these low-level drug-related offenses. So at the same time that Cleveland police were arresting Clevelanders of color in droves for things like simple drug possession and crack pipes, the same time that that was happening, in a back office in the same police department, rape testing kits were piling up and getting dust, right? No one was paying attention to what was truly a crisis of safety happening. So this imbalance between a justice system that gets really good at pursuing low-level related offenses, drug-related offenses, really good at surveilling, and all of that, by the way, particularly in communities of color, that's where, you know, a bunch of incarceration skyrocketed off of that kind of activity, at the same time that many cities were experiencing a backlog in testing rape kits, we're experiencing very low homicide closure rates. I mean, you know, there are some cities where the rate of closure of homicide cases, which means was the case solved, right? Yeah. You know, hovers around 25%. You know, 15, 25% of sexual assault cases, homicide cases are being effectively investigated and prosecuted or closed at the same time that, you know, we're seeing incarceration skyrocket over these other types of crimes.
And so that's,
you know, so that's sort of another expression of this hierarchy of harm of what do we really care about and what are these resources going to? you know, part of your question was, what do we do different, right? What did it look like to reimagine this whole system? There's so many remarkable opportunities, and we're in an exciting time. I have to say, I've just been so inspired by just even the last few years of what's happened across the country. We've seen a movement for what my colleague Akila Shareels calls community-based public safety. And what does this mean? Well, this means rather than building up the justice system, which has been ineffective for far too long, let's equip communities with the capacity to prevent cycles of violence. And this is what you can invest in to equip communities to thrive. Violence intervention programs. These are community-based conflict mediation, youth mentorship type of programs where residents support young people who may be getting in trouble to turn their lives around and get to safety. Another example, trauma recovery centers, community-based programs that can provide victims who have been overlooked by the traditional justice system with not just therapeutic support, but also emergency crisis response. There's mental health crisis assistance. We've seen a lot more attention to that in the news, as opposed to relying on the justice system to respond to people in psychiatric crisis. Let's instead provide mental health crisis responders who can support people experiencing mental illness. And then, you have reentry. The programs for reentry that are building up across the country are just remarkable, doing work helping people find jobs and housing after incarceration or after time in the justice system. Mark, that's the new safety movement that I just described, right? That's where we're seeing so much more energy and so much more growth. And it's just really exciting to see it.
Obviously, cities in the US are much bigger than cities in the UK. But if I think about close-knit communities, before there was lots of, let's say, migration between countries, cities, back in probably the 60s and 70s, certainly in the UK, the local community would know who was the person to look out for. They need a wee bit of help. They've got a problem. We need to nip this one in the bud and stop them from escalating. People knew that the community looks after itself. Well, I suppose it's just natural the way the world has gone that, with the aside from the changes that you've described, the communities became less driven by centers of community, let's say churches or community centers and families. Probably there wasn't such a great sort of connectivity between certain communities. So it's, in a way, it's probably natural that those safeguards disappeared. So what you're describing just sounds like the common sense way that any community can look after itself and be preventative.
Yeah, and it's critical to understand there were policy decisions that drove these realities, right? When there was a crisis of, drugs in the 80s and 90s, the response was militarization of police and mass surveillance. That has a direct impact on communities who are being surveilled. Many observers of that era in U.S. history accurately argue that it contributed to violence more than it ever empowered communities to overcome, challenges as it relates to substance use disorder. So, I think that it matters a lot at the level of policy. Do we see communities affected by violence as partners in resolving it or as problems to be surveilled? And we either give communities dignity and support natural leadership and empower people who can solve these problems, or we end up building up a massive justice system that's better at surveilling than it is stopping cycles.
There's another thing you talk about in your book that I was sort of slightly aware of, but didn't realize it was such a groundswell of opinion, that what led to these policy changes in the 80s to support victims' rights haven't actually supported victims' rights. And when you actually ask victims what their opinions are, what they seek in terms of justice, it's less about punitive penalties and it's increasingly more about the desire for rehabilitation. And it's something that previous guest David Risley talked about in restorative justice systems. So can you just expand upon that and what you're seeing in terms of what victims really seek?
So my organization, we have conducted surveys and interviews with diverse victims of crime. We surveyed more than 10,000 survivors of a crime and violence in the last decade. And we have done these surveys to be able to elevate representative opinions. Much of the time, when it comes to what the public thinks victims want, it's driven by anecdote. It's driven by one story that made the media, that drove news coverage for, you know, several cycles. So we wanted to counter that with representative information, which is why we engaged in research and surveying. And what we found is, you know, first of all, there is no monolith. You know, victims have a wide range of opinions and a wide range of desires from the criminal justice system. But one of the most common things that we have found across demographic groups is that what victims want is for what happened to them to not happen again. And the resulting policy preference is for rehabilitation and more investments into things like mental health, crisis assistance and violence prevention over and above extreme sentencing, because it would be more effective at stopping the cycle of crime. You know, when you look at, you know, what victims are saying through our surveys and research, there's a 2-to-1 preference for rehabilitation over punishment. You know, a 5-to-1 preference for shorter sentences if it means we can put more money into crime prevention and violence prevention. You know, those are the kinds of trade-offs that matter a lot for our public policy officials to understand, because it kind of flies in the face of what that mythological, you know, story is that's out there about who victims are and what they want.
Just as an aside, do you ever get into conversations with policymakers just using international examples of different models of, like, the Scandinavian models and what they do in Norway in terms of their justice systems, which are radically different?
Yeah, you know, there was a tour of, you know, probably about 8 or 9 years ago, there was a group of public officials, mostly from California, but I don't know that it was exclusive, who actually went and visited the German correction system for the purposes of understanding some of the key differences between that system and our system in the United States. And, you know, there's a few key features that matter a lot when it comes to public safety. One is that in some of those other systems, what we see is a goal of rehabilitation. The goal is not maximum punishment. The goal is rehabilitation. And built into the correction system is an anticipation that the person is going to be returning. And so we want the person to be returning as capably as possible, you know, so that they can not just be law abiding, but be active contributing members of our families and communities. So it's just a completely different orientation. And I think when public officials have an opportunity to experience that firsthand, it does have a kind of a breakthrough impact in terms of their understanding. You know, and I would say the same about looking at restorative justice models, whether that's international or domestic. When people who are, you know, not familiar with an alternative way of repairing harm, when they see what happens in restorative justice programs, it's life-changing for them.
The great thing with your book, because it provides this, say, historical context and tells some great stories rather than just using data to bring to life the injustices and the experiences of victims and this examples of this hurt people hurting people. Now, healing people can heal people. But what's great in the latter part of your book, I think in the sort of last, from chapter 10 to 14, I think it was, you set out a roadmap and a vision of a more just system. Can you provide an overview and some examples? I mean, I know you've touched on it already in terms of this community-based solutions, but you have clearly thought about and looked at what can be effective and why it is a viable alternative to what exists now if embraced at scale. And also the fact, I think it's interesting as well, is that you've done the math, you've broken down the cost and the show of the sort of the level one, level two, level three, and the impact that it can actually have.
And so the first thing that I describe as needed in my book for a new approach to public safety is transforming what we conceive of when we talk about victims' rights. Mm-hmm. For a long time, the traditional way of looking at victims' rights is a right to speak in court proceedings and things that are valuable but are woefully inadequate. You know, one of the things I lift up is this idea of a right to trauma recovery, that we should prioritize ensuring that when people are hurt by violence, that they get access to real support to recover from that trauma. That looks like trauma recovery centers. That looks like school and housing and employment accommodations. And that is possible if we prioritize recovering from trauma. The second proposal that I make is really related to recognizing that we don't know very much about who victims are and what victims want. You know, most of the time, conversations around criminal justice and crime revolve around crime statistics. Mm. And that's it's so limited in its viewpoint. Crime statistics are a very limited snapshot of only what is reported to police. Most crime and violence is not reported to police. And so looking just at what comes in to law enforcement, you know, on a day or a year isn't going to tell you very much. So, you know, there's a need to take seriously this idea of human-centered information, information related to victimization and information related to what people who aren't experiencing safety in their homes or communities are going through and what their needs are. So we need, you know, we need a new right for victims and we need new data. And then the third thing I talk about is sort of what you were referencing there in terms of the cost. This concept of scaling up a new approach to safety. It is so much more cost effective to invest in community-based violence intervention workers, community-based trauma recovery center workers, mental health crisis assistance responders, and reentry case managers. That's the forefront of the new safety leadership. That's who we should be investing in at the community level. And I offer some estimates of what all that would look like financially. But the headline is it'd be much cheaper than the $300 billion we spend per year on our current criminal justice system.
You'd think the wily politician, whatever side of the party lines they sit, would see an opportunity in this. That something going, well, I'm going to save you taxpayers a shit ton of money, and this is how we're going to do it. And we're going to make you safer at the same time. And it doesn't use the words tough on crime. It's tough on crime. It's tough on taxpayers. Let's change the narrative. I mean, that just seems like it's a policy decision and a winning policy decision waiting to be snapped up by some smart politician. Why aren't they getting it?
Well, you know, they're growing in numbers. I got to say, they're politicians on both sides of the aisle have in fact talked about the budget busting nature of our approach to criminal justice and how we just literally simply can't afford to do this sort of dysfunctional, incarcerate our way to safety approach. You know, I've been so excited and inspired to see politicians who are forward thinking in that way make some real honest proposals. You know, there's entrenched interests here, Mark. You know, there's the narrative, there's talking to voters about the trade-offs. Those things really matter. But, you know, we have to be honest that, you know, there's associations, you know, others who hire lobbyists and, you know, go work the Capitol and
opposing lobby groups. Yeah.
Well, you know, one of the challenges with building up these big bureaucracies is some of these criminal justice bureaucracies, the thing that they're best at is protecting their own financial interests, really.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we have to be honest about that. And again, there's so many good people who work inside, all layers of criminal justice systems who want a different way. But those interests are not always represented by these associations that walk the capitals. And, you know, so we have to engage with the forward-thinking leaders inside the justice system, the forward-thinking politicians who are willing to stand up for what's rational and build the movement that way.
Red, I'm learning about the system and criminal justice and reform. But there's lots of organizations NGOs, charities working in this area, you know, from the Innocence Project, which obviously has deals with the has a different side of the of the system, to other projects that really focus on getting reducing recidivism and creating economic opportunity for ex-inmates. As this is a system-wide problem, how are you working with other organizations in collectively to, let's say, to create a unified narrative so that there isn't just individual organizations chipping away at this massive system that is essentially the industrialized criminal justice system? Is there more that can be done?
Yeah, we have some wonderful partners that we work with to advance, you know, our efforts. You know, at the federal level, we have something called the National Coalition for Shared Safety. And that's a coalition that involves leaders, you know, from violence prevention, leaders from reentry, mental health and victim services, all sort of working together on unified messages and unified strategies to get more federal dollars to go to these kinds of solutions at the community level. You know, and in each of our states, we work with a really wide range of, you know, collaborators and coalition partners. You know, our organization is nonpartisan. We take great pride in our capacity to partner across the political spectrum to advance change. You know, so we have all kinds of partners, whether it's grassroots or political organizations or, you know, labor associations, business associations, faith associations. Mm-hmm. There, you know, a lot of the time, you know, what's possible in terms of coalition is really driven by if resources are available to allow for organizations to collaborate. So we've been really grateful for, you know, philanthropy's interest in seeing more and more organizations come together. And, you know, I think there's a lot of possibility out there for even more collaboration moving forward. But, you know, just to give you an example, you know, faith-based organizations have played a huge role in advocating for criminal justice reform, and so is the business sector. You know, in Michigan, you know, Michigan passed a series of what are called clean slate laws. And these are laws that allow people with old records to clear their records so they can become eligible for jobs and housing. And the clean slate package in Michigan was passed not just with, you know, public safety and criminal justice reform organizations like mine, but also business leaders. They were a huge ally in that campaign. And they really, because of that partnership with business leaders and also faith leaders, that was sort of the three-part coalition that was able to get Clean Slate passed in Michigan.
That's really interesting. What, just as a matter of interest, what states do you operate? You said seven or eight states?
Yeah, the big ones. So we're in Texas. We're in Florida, California, Illinois, Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Arizona.
So what I'm doing with the podcast, and I think I explained to you before, is when David will join us shortly, hopefully, although that's not a serendipitous connection, I want to look at creating or facilitating what I'm calling random collisions, to look at where there might not be an obvious connection between someone working in an area to affect, make a difference in the world, but where when you look at it at a system-wide level, it's all connected. So whether that be criminal justice reform, what's happened, what you're doing, whether it be related to changes in the education system. Hi, David.
Hello.
Hi, David. Hi.
Lenore, it's been so long.
I'll just finish off my question. And to look at where there's an intersection between maybe needs for changes and reform in education with the criminal justice system, with mental health, with the attitudes and use of and of social media, all of them in some way, when you're looking at the negative externalities or the issues that need change or leading to a societal level trauma. And it's interesting, I was reading about Esther Perel's husband, who I didn't know about, Jack Saul, who runs the trauma program at Columbia University. And I'm going to try and get him on. But what I'd like to do at some point is, once I get a few more interviews under my belt with these difference makers like yourself, is to do a random collision event and bring everyone together to talk about trauma from their different perspectives and see where there's intersections and where there can be collaboration and benefit of connecting these people together. So as long as you're open to that, I'd put you on the list.
Love it.
Cool. Okay. counts for you as well, David, by the way, you know that. And also, yeah, what I need to do as well, and my final question is, you know, who do I interview next? Because I want to tap into your network, into your wisdom, your experiences to help me connect these people that are all action takers, that are all creating progress, albeit in small steps in some cases and not as fast as you want, but collectively. Yeah. I think people need to know that there's a lot of people out there taking action, driving change. And I've got a massive train line right next to me. You know, one of these long Texas trains drives me nuts. Yeah. So as long as you're open to that, that would be great.
Absolutely.
And it's all based on reciprocity. So you don't have to answer it now, but the question will be, who do I interview next? So,
well, I can send you a long list.
Excellent. Well, we'll do that afterwards.
And Lenore, anyway, you can guess who was on my list. That was you.
No,
yeah, you.
Okay, great.
Anyway, now that I've got you both here and you're working in parallel, let's say parallel tracks with the same intent, which is to confront the injustice in the system. And I'd just love to get both your perspectives on where your work intersects, so I understand that, and also in terms of where there might be an opportunity to get you together in some sort of design thinking workshop, and who else would have to be in that to make it beneficial, whether it be someone working within state government, or be an elected official of some description. You know, it's really just to get you to bounce off each other for a minute or two.
What are your thoughts on that, David?
Well, first of all, the intersection, as we talked about in our conversation yesterday, episode 17 of Just as Voices, the intersection, I think, is twofold. One, the commonality of trauma as a common denominator in both the victim side and the perpetrator of harm side of the crime equation, and the need to address it if we're going to achieve either justice on the one hand or public safety on the other. It's a win-win if trauma is addressed. It's a lose-lose if trauma is not. By not, I mean neither for the victim or for the perpetrator of the harm that caused the trauma to the victim. The second thing, though, is this connection that you so powerfully describe between the victim rights, which, rather than just rights, let's call it victim healing, and public safety, which, by my definition of justice as healing, is, again, I mean, I suppose it's just another way of saying much the same thing, but when you make that connection between healing for the victim and public safety, that includes necessarily healing for the community and for everyone impacted by that. I just did recorded a conversation yesterday with Jeff Ford, which will be in the episode of Justice Voices to follow you. Jeff Ford is just recently retired as a state court judge in a problem-solving drug court. And we talked about problem-solving in the justice system. It can be done, even without dramatic changes in the system. So that, I think, is the commonality. And I think the angle you take, Lenore, is so powerful, which is if we solve the victim side of the equation, we at the same time are solving a great deal of the perpetrator side of the equation and reducing crime.
I mean, you've written quite very eloquently, David, about your justice visions strategy, which is about reform and redirection of funds and the redesign of the system wholeheartedly. Which part of that, I can't really recall whether there was elements within that did talk about what Lenore covers around this trauma, this victim healing and trauma support within the community. Is there something in your document that touches on that?
Yes, it's the part that I call victim voices.
Uh-huh.
The voices of the victims, those are stories that need to be told, and those are voices that need to be heard. And strategically, it's not just because that's just fair. I mean, why would you give voice to the perpetrators of harm and not the victims of harm? So it's just part of the justice equation that I'm trying to flesh out, because it is complex. I mean, there's a lot of elements to it. There are a lot of voices. But the victim voices part of that is strategically part of reimagining our approach to criminal justice as a problem-solving approach rather than a punishment approach or paradigm. And this is exactly what Lenore zeroes in on.
So when we talk about the size, I mean, the scale of the change, even in 8 states, is massive. But when you boil it down to neighborhood level or city level, then you're talking about sort of a manageable, and it's obviously, I mentioned, Lenore, the examples you've given in the book. Where is there a role for public-private partnerships? I mean, I've got an interview coming up with a guy called Bracken Darrell, who is the CEO of Logitech. And his focus for the next 10 years is to address diversity, equity, inclusion, and justice within his organization's orbit, to address the stigma of mental health and to become carbon positive. Now, within that, I know full well that for them, one of their challenges as an organization, being operating in California, is talent. Yeah. And I talked about David before about the underutilized talent and creative talent that exists in a lot of these communities. So as you make the economic argument for savings in taxpayers' money, there's also the benefit to society as people avoid going down one route, start to utilize their talents and become a resource for local businesses, not just a resource, a market. So there's an upside argument to be made to local businesses, whether they be small, medium-sized, or even corporates in these states, that they have a responsibility, and it's a system-wide problem as problem solvers and committed to what most companies would have as some commitment to the UN's global goals. But when you apply those global goals down to a local level, you know, you can't divorce yourself from what's happening on the ground. So I think there is a conversation that needs to be had in these areas where you're looking at making these arguments for change, not just to say to the local communities, let's get funding for this. Where do brands or local businesses play a part?
You know, I'm sure David has thoughts on this as well. But I mean, just to lift up, you know, a lot of really phenomenal neighborhood-based community safety programs have been formed out of public-private partnerships. Many of the trauma recovery centers that we support get a mix of philanthropic dollars as well as local business support as well as government dollars. The same can be said for many of the reentry programs. You know, I think what it takes is it takes leadership, and it takes leadership either from the private sector or the public sector, but the leadership to bring those two sectors together and say, we want to collaborate to support these types of community-based safety programs. In almost every neighborhood I've ever come across, these programs already exist. They're operating on a dime, and they haven't been invested in by either the private sector or the public sector. You know, people fundraise on a, you know, monthly and annual basis to keep their doors open, despite the fact that they're, you know, doing more than most to stop cycles of harm. And so, you know, I think it's really a question of, can we corral the kinds of leadership that it would take to make these investments from both the public sector and the private sector, and really establish capacity, community capacity, equipping communities with the kinds of solutions that would make a big difference. The examples are there. You know, it's really a question of scale.
And Mark, I can offer an example. I think when you and I talked earlier, I made some mention to this. In Chicago, Chicago is a city of neighborhoods. And one of those neighborhoods, an historic, predominantly Black community, is Bronzeville. And Bronzeville is historic, but it also struggles with, these days, with some serious crime issues. When I was in the governor's office, I met a pastor there, Pastor Chris Harris. He leads the Bright Star Church there in the Bronzeville community. And he founded an organization called Bright Star Community Outreach. And the part of that that really attracted my attention was that somehow, I mean, he and I are going to get together for an episode of Justice Voices to discuss this subject in the near future. But he, whether on a trip to Israel or something, connected with an organization that has the goes by the acronym NATAL, N-A-T-A-L, that dealt with trauma for victims of terrorism in Israel. Well, he brought them to Bronzeville, and they trained people in his church and in the community in trauma-informed care for people in the community. And they ended up, this kind of took off. They developed the Greater Bronzeville Community Action Plan. And this has over 50 Bronzeville organizations that work together to make a community level impact on violence and trauma. And that some of the partners in this effort are Northwestern University Medicine, School of Medicine, University of Chicago School of Medicine, United Way of Metro Chicago, the Jewish United Fund, and Sinai Community Institute, Centers for Disease Control, and of course, others in the community. Now, this is a whole community action plan that was started by a pastor in the community who was well-connected as part of his community, bringing together all these disparate elements. They even provide trauma services to the police in the community because police officers are subjected to trauma almost on a daily basis as a part of their job, both in terms of experiences that they receive as the recipient of hostility and sometimes violence, but also the things that they observe are traumatic. Well, the people in the community, and they're trying to change the community by addressing the trauma that is being individually and collectively experienced within the community. And everybody has a piece of that, a part of that. And there are synergies that have developed. So the Greater Bronzeville Community Action Plan is, I think, an example of what you're talking about.
Yeah, that's a great example. Well, I'm conscious of time, and I think it's been a wonderful conversation, Lenore. I don't know if there's anything else you want to raise that you haven't mentioned, or David, if there's anything you want to raise.
I have had such a great time talking with you, Mark, and I just enjoyed our conversation yesterday as well, David. You know, I just so appreciate the thoughtfulness and the attention that y'all are paying to this. You know, I think we're living in a really exciting time. I think things are changing fast. The stakes are obviously very high, but the work on the ground is happening, and you know, new stakeholders are really making a claim for a different approach to safety, and it's very exciting to be a part of it, and really exciting to talk to both of you about it.
I think one thing you need to consider is maybe getting a reimagined Mohican. that would start getting people's attention. You got your focus on your fashion, and you got to finish it off with that mohawk. Bring that rebel back. Well, the question I didn't ask you is, what were the bands that you were into when you were this young rebel?
Oh, well, you know, classics, right? So I loved the Misfits and, you know, the Dead Kennedys and Social Distortion and
California Uber Alice.
Yeah, and DRI, you know, all the classics. You know, you name it. If it was punk and fast, I was into it.
Yeah, wonderful. Oh, for those days. Anyway, it's been a wonderful conversation. I really enjoyed it, and an important conversation to have. So I really appreciate it.
Appreciate it so very much. Thank you. Thanks to both of you.
David, and thank you as well.
You bet. See what happens when you recommend somebody, Lenore.
There you go.
Yeah. Collisions.
Collisions. That's right. All right.
All right. Bye. See you later.
Thanks, folks. Okay, bye. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Okay. That's all for now, folks. Now, here's my ask of you. Please follow this podcast on Apple or Spotify or whatever player you use. Also, please subscribe to our new Random Collisions newsletter. We really are working to build a global community of action takers, action engines of people that really care about the problems that need solving. Thank you very much, and see you next time.